I'm for that. Kind of
guide the
money. Kind of guide the money in the right direction.
Quorum is still present. First bill on the agenda is Senate File 1560. Senator Pretner Solon.
This is John's, yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Solon?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I have the A2 amendment to put it in the author's desired format.
A2, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails, amendments adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate File 1560 is a bill that will authorize $475,000 to fund studies and other activities related to terrestrial and geologic carbon sequestration or the capture and storage of atmospheric CO2 in either plants and soils or in deep geologic formations. Preliminary studies at the University of Minnesota indicate that terrestrial or biological sequestration could play a role in reducing the state's net CO2 emissions. Many land management practices that promote carbon sequestration can increase the health and productivity of forests and agricultural lands and have broad environmental benefits for soils, water, and biodiversity. Underground storage of gaseous and liquid materials in porous geological formations is a common practice, for example, to store natural gas during summer seasons. Geologic storage of carbon dioxide on a large scale has yet to be demonstrated, but it is seeing limited application in enhanced oil recovery operations. With proposals pending in Minnesota for large new sources of carbon dioxide emissions, primarily in the electrical power sector, we need to determine whether future storage of CO2 in Minnesota might be feasible. Studies funded by this bill will provide needed scientific information on these two sequestration options. For terrestrial sequestration, it will request the University of Minnesota to quantify sequestration capacities of Minnesota forests, agricultural lands, wetlands, and prairies, and to plan a monitoring network and demonstration projects to document this potential. We'll also assess state policy options to increase terrestrial sequestration and coordinate activities through the Minnesota Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative. Not being a scientist, my tongue has a hard time getting around some of these words. I don't use them that often. For geologic sequestration, it funds a preliminary study by the Minnesota Geological Society, or survey, to determine whether further analysis of geologic formations in Minnesota is warranted. Information generated by these studies is crucial to developing and evaluating public policies and private investments in the state's emissions mitigation and climate protection efforts. And with me today are Bill Grant of the Isaac Walton League and Cheryl Miller, coordinator of the Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative. They will address the committee briefly, and then we will all stand for questions after they have spoken. Are you first?
Sure.
Okay. Cheryl Miller will go first.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Cheryl Miller, project coordinator of the Minnesota Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative. I would like to tell you just a little bit about the task force that I represent. It was formed 2 years ago and based at the university. It's a task force of government agency representatives, private stakeholders, and university researchers who came together to try to start figuring out how terrestrial carbon sequestration could work in Minnesota, what would be a really optimal way to apply this idea in this state. In the 1990s, the scientific community started really highlighting the importance that natural systems, forests, agricultural lands, wetlands, prairies, pasture lands, the role that those ecosystems play in the carbon balance, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the amount of carbon that's stored in the land and in plants. CO2 is taken up by plants as they grow and turned into wood and leaves and root systems and then into the soils. And that role, that ability of plants to do that, suddenly has a whole new role in as we start thinking about excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So there has been a lot of research and a lot of policy discussions about how we could ramp up existing conservation programs, many of these practices that protect or enhance existing carbon stocks are agricultural practices and forestry practices that are very well known, but now could really be applied as part of a climate strategy. They also have broad environmental benefits, and they could provide a new source of rural income, landowner income. So there's been a lot of states that have picked up on this in the last decade, and this group at the university has started to collect information, started holding meetings with stakeholder groups. We've had educational conferences, published some white papers on ways that Minnesotans and policymakers, you, could start understanding this issue and how to really bring it forward. So this bill would add, kind of take some of our preliminary research, which is mostly a desk study, it's published papers, and now really start applying it to the ground here. And it give the information that we'll need to be able to come back a year from now is what we'd like to do and say these are the really big opportunities here to think about some of the policies and programs that might be beneficial.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Mr. Grant, please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League, and I want to speak to the other side of the carbon sequestration equation, and that's geological carbon sequestration. As Senator Pretner Solon points out, we really at this point don't have a good idea about whether or not there's a sequestration potential in Minnesota. The bill directs the Minnesota Geologic Survey at the University of Minnesota School of Earth Sciences to study the potential for geologic sequestration in the area known as the Mid-Continent Rift. And this formation runs roughly north and south along the Minnesota-Wisconsin border between Duluth and the Twin Cities. It is an area of highly permeable rock, at some depth, not close to the surface. And the study will evaluate published data about similar types of formations to determine whether further analysis of that geology here in the state is worthy of further analysis, i.e., actually drilling holes to determine whether the rock formation is suitable for this type of geologic storage. Also, as Senator Pretner Solon pointed out, we're accustomed as a society to storing gaseous and liquid materials underground in similar types of formations. It's something we do already with natural gas during summer seasons. There are a whole host of liquid and gaseous materials that we store in this manner. But if we're going to store carbon dioxide underground, we want to make sure that it's not going to be released, certainly not in the near term, hopefully not ever. And otherwise, what would be the point of putting it underground? We want to keep it out of the atmosphere. So the studies that are underway across the country really are looking into whether or not this can be done at a large scale. And those areas of the country that already have a fair amount of oil and natural gas development already have been fairly well surveyed in terms of their ability to do this kind of storage. Minnesota, because we don't have any of that type of development, we really don't know whether formations here are suitable to this type of activity, but we think that this area, again, along the Minnesota-Wisconsin border, holds some potential. I have here with us tonight Tony Runkel from the State Geologic Survey. They would be the organization directed to do this preliminary analysis. If you have any questions that I can't answer, I'm sure that he would be able to.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Questions? Senator, do you want to walk us through the bill and point out its high points, or I guess at this point, as questions come to mind, let's try to get them answered on the fly.
Mr. Chair, I actually did walk through the bill as I was giving my I didn't point out section by section, but
okay.
Basically I did tell you what the scope of the bill was.
Questions for our witnesses? Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair and members and to the witnesses, I think I like this bill, and I understand the need to repeat research and make sure that it's right, because getting the same results from multiple researchers at different locations means more than having one person do the same thing over and over and over again. But I'm just guessing that on this terrestrial carbon sequestration assessment, there must be a fair amount of research already, I would think anyway, as to how much carbon dioxide forest, agricultural land, peatlands, wetlands, and so forth sequester. Because there is something known as, I think it's called the carbon exchange in Chicago, where you can buy carbon credits. And right now this month there is a series of meetings across Minnesota to line up farmers that are using no-till systems to tap into this carbon exchange and get some extra revenue if they're no-till farmers and so forth. So my guess is we already know, and at least there's there must be some research as to how much carbon is taken out by different types of forest lands and so forth. Would that not be true?
Senator Dill, the Chicago Climate Exchange does use some default figures for what would be expected carbon sequestration under several different practices, three or four different practices. There are many more practices that could be applied in a state as diverse as Minnesota. And what we're interested in is, going out and really ground truthing, or really understanding how this would apply to our particular ecosystem. Minnesota, cooler, more organic soils, there is very likely higher rates for some practices here than there are further south, for instance. So the idea of all of these states gradually need to start really doing baseline studies and applying the numbers very specifically to their different regions. We have published a kind of preliminary paper that shows estimates for what a number of different practices that have, we think, very high value. But those are published papers from other states kind of in this region. But it would be very good to be able to go into different regions of Minnesota, different counties of Minnesota, and start developing that kind of information. That's really going to be essential as we move further towards emissions trading and offset, is to get very, very detailed information in hand.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, I think this is a good idea, because we need to do more research and then double check the research that's already been done. And like you say, we have a different ecosystem than maybe Wisconsin or whatever. So I think it's a good idea.
And Mr. Chair, I would say that as we move forward with our global warming proposals that are coming before the state, that it's very important for us to come up with plans for how we are going to be able to sequester CO2 or find offsets for our current, for any expanded baseload that we might need.
Just one other thought.
Miguel?
Mr. Chairman, members, another angle on this is that if you do find that there's a certain practice out there, production practice on the farm, that does result in quite a bit of carbon sequestration, that would give the farmer a way to try to deal with the climate exchange and show that he really deserves even more money for the carbon he's sequestered.
That's exactly right, Senator Dill. There's very few practices that are allowed, and For instance, pastures are not allowed. And if we can collect good information about that, it would be very useful.
Did you talk a little bit about how this is different from Dr. Tillman's work?
Senator Chandri, Dr. Tillman has looked at biomass, biofuel crops, and the levels of terrestrial sequestration associated with that, with diverse prairies. This and then, so his research has to do with biofuels and with the carbon sequestration associated with that particular land practice or land use. Our study is much broader. We look at forests, shrublands, wetlands, other kinds of prairies, other kinds of crops, cover crops on agricultural fields, many, many different types of land uses. So we are actually going to be working with Dr. Tillman on this next study. And this the section that talks about developing a monitoring benchmark sites around the state and using that to identify demonstration projects for different kinds of land practices, Dr. Tillman and his group will be associated with that work.
I think also, Mr. Chair, the part about the carbon sequestration in terms of the geologic rifts is a new area, too, in that there may be areas, naturally formed areas, where carbon can be sequestered as not unlike, I guess, the oil wells or where the carbon sequestration can occur in areas where there are oil wells. But, you know, if this and that isn't something that's been available to us up here. So if we could find areas where there are geological rifts or places where it can naturally be sequestered, it would be great for us in this area. I was hoping that maybe even the Laurentian Divide or areas like that might be eligible for something like that.
On the page 1, line 14, it says the University of Minnesota is requested to conduct a study. Is that normal language? What if they don't want to do one?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think that we can demand it. But maybe Mr. Grant can respond to that.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it from Council, this is the way that funding requests for the university are typically drafted. I may be wrong about that, but I don't believe that this is unusual language.
Ms. Baker? Stuff is normally written.
I've seen that many times at the university, right? Because they need the money to go with it. If this were to pass without an appropriation, demanding a study of them.
Okay.
It's polite.
All right. I guess I got to share my feelings. I really think your bill does the right thing, and we ought to do this. I thought I learned in kindergarten that trees need carbon dioxide and to survive, and they emit oxygen and other plants. So if we have less of them, we will have more carbon dioxide.
Did you impose this amendment?
And now we kind of have a intellectual industry along that concept called carbon sequestration. Aren't we just kind of, does this need to be studied? Is there that much question about that simple concept that we need to prove it? I don't mean to put anyone on a spot because I agree with your bro. I agree with everything you're doing. But just, I'm glad you're doing the study. We need to do it. But I'm also sad, on the other hand, that we need to do this.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I think we all do remember that from elementary physics and or chemistry, and that there is that relationship, that carbon cycle in the atmosphere, and that plants tend to take up CO2 and emit oxygen, which of course we need for our own life on the planet. What we don't know in specific terms, specific enough for there to be a tradable credit associated with making those kinds of reductions, is exactly what kinds of practices sequester exactly how much carbon and for what length of time, so that we can quantify that in a way that allows it to be reduced to an actual monetary instrument, a credit that can be traded for the right to produce a ton of CO2 by another activity. And that's why the state has an interest, I believe, in this type of research, to be able to form the baseline that we need to do that kind of economic trading of credits once we as a country or we as a state decide that we're going to limit the amount of CO2 we're going to allow into the atmosphere.
So the report will have a lot of quantification. It won't just say less trees, more carbon dioxide. It's going to say these are all the ways we can quantify our losses and gains in this area. Senator?
Mr. Chair, one of the questions that's raised in the Energy Committee a lot in the offsets is how many trees do we have to plant in order to offset the amount of carbon we're emitting? And so those are the types of questions we need answers to.
Senator Chaudhry, this would also fund the continuation of this group that has been meeting, an expanded version of this group, to try to come up with some what-if scenarios, some different approaches that we could take the quantified information and then develop some strategies for how we could reduce CO2 emissions through something like this in a much more quantified way.
Senator Bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, what I'd be interested in is if you take a field of corn using conventional tillage and production practices, that corn is taking CO2 out of the air during the year. It's growing during the summer and fall and spring, but then it dies. And I'd be interested to know what it did during the year in terms of pounds of CO2 removed. And, of course, you've got some release when you're doing the tillage and so forth, because that's oftentimes when a lot of the CO2 leaves the soil, is when you're tilling it. I'd like to see that compared to a no-till system where you're doing nothing but planting and controlling weeds with herbicides and harvesting and so forth, where you have less tillage, you're releasing less CO2, and how much CO2 is coming out of the air into the corn plant under those conditions. And then comparing that to soybeans in a no-till versus a tillage, more of a conventional tillage system, versus a prairie grass system where you're producing cellulosic products for future ethanol plants, and how much CO2 is coming out of the air under those conditions where there's no tillage, a deep-rooted system where the plant lives for 100 years or more, so you don't have the roots dying. Like in a cornfield, you got the roots dying every year and decomposing and releasing CO2. So I think there's a lot of very interesting research that I would be interested in seeing what's happening out there. We're talking about trees, but how do those trees compare to a wetland, canary grass meadow, and all these other options that are out there, to see how it really does? And then just on the tree side, maybe an oak tree is better than an aspen. The aspen's kicking the bucket every 30 years, and the oak tree lasts for 200 years. I don't know which is better, but it'd be nice to know.
Well, they've got that in there, Senator. They've got agricultural lands they're going to study and different types of crops. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important to know. Okay, Senator Ingrickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. We're talking about almost $1 million worth of...
That's my question.
I'm sorry.
No, Mr. Chair, it's $475,000.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's total.
Okay. Right.
Just to follow up with that. Okay, with that kind of money, and I guess I have to echo what the chair is talking about when he says we have to ask the Board of Regents of the state of Minnesota to do it, or are they on board to do it? Is it a pretty much a given thing? Or I see that as far as the information handed out, they are one of the stakeholders. I'm assuming that's what's going to happen. Is that a fair question?
Ingebrigtsen, yes, the university is on board on this. They developed the study or helped put together the plans for the study. So
the U is an autonomous entity, senators, so, and they're separate in our constitution, and so we have to be more polite in telling them what to do.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
But Mr. Chairman, they still want the money from us.
Yeah,
I believe they do.
Mr. Chair.
I'll take it out of the way.
Mr. Chair.
Pretner Solon.
I'm assuming it's their intellectual property, and so we have to pay a portion of it.
There you go. All right.
Very well put.
Senator Scogin moves that Senate file 1560 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
So moved.
Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas. Pappas is on her way.
Holly Berman needed Dyson Luther. Where did it go? I can't remember. Where did the bill go? Finance?
This one? Mm-hmm. That was a good one.
Laid over for us.
Finance.
It went to finance. Oh,
to finance.
Oh, it went to finance. Oh,
it wasn't me either. You asked me.
Sorry.
Olson says, you know, root butters are bad. So it's never really
Yeah. It's just really, I understand where the language is at.
Requested to do
that. Ellen is one that got one of those firewood fortune cookies.
Oh yeah.
Right. I'd never.
Surprise.
You're saving us from them by eating them. Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yes, right. Well, I have an energy
team. Oh,
you're not saying that you have to.
I know. I wanted to know.
That's why they gave you the answer.
Well, and that should come.
Oh,
that
was very clever.
Everybody sat around and jawed.
Plus, it's peeled.
Everybody wasn't there.
What was served?
Oh, they had ziti, you know, which is like rigatoni with tomato sauce. They had a salad, a mixed vegetable salad, and they had sandwiches.
Who's moving this one off?
Where is it?
Nobody. It was sitting on top of it. You couldn't mix it up without getting to pour out. So most people didn't use the first one. And then what else do we have? Jen, what else do we have besides salad, sandwiches, and pasta? Is that it? Yeah. Oh, and pot. Three kinds of pot. Right, yeah. Which I hardly ever drink.
I haven't run yesterday, so I went out there. I have leftover spaghetti from last yesterday.
I forgot to do my stuff that I had yesterday for lunch, so I'll bring it tomorrow.
If I'm lucky, I ate food on Sunday, right. So I have leftovers to take home. Better take to my apartment.
Yeah. I do that too, man. Okay. Usually I make one large pot of something.
Provide some interesting information.
Yeah. Like I have three meals, 2 days of meals on it.
But I didn't like the wetland one, so it was just furry.
So I'm glad we didn't take out tonight.
That for Pappas?
I think we can wait a year.
Yeah, a year along.
We'll turn on.
We should have had a lot of witnesses here for polybrominated diethyl diphenyl ether.
Yeah, boot it up. Yeah, boot it up. Senate File 651, Senator Pappas.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Sorry you were waiting for me. The goal of Senate File 651 is really to put in place a phase out of PDEs, which are flame retardants. PDEs are a chemical cousin to PCBs, so we certainly know about all the problems we've had with PCBs over the years. It took 40 years to ban it, with after wrecking kind of havoc on the environment. PDEs are a neurotoxin. They break down in dust, so they're more dangerous to children who crawl around and put their hands in their mouth. The legislation, the first section starts out with a definition. Oh, Mr. Chairman, I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment. I just remembered.
Okay, we'll pass that out.
And I had a, did I have a further change? Yeah. Was that on the original bill?
Three witnesses.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A1 amendment, and then on the bill, I also have another amendment at the request of the Department of Administration, and that's on page 3, line 312, after charity, comma, insert public entities. And then that would put the bill in the shape that I'd like it to be in.
Okay, we've got the A1 and then the oral addition. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendments adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What the bill does is it inserts definitions for what the amendment does. It inserts definitions for computer and television, and it outlines a different exemption process that's more detailed than is in the current bill. What the bill proposed to do, plans to do, is to totally phase out what's called Penta and Octa. And beginning January 1st, 2008, and with DECA in Subdivision 2, it phases that out as of 2010. It also lists a series of exemptions where certain products can continue to contain PBDEs, which is transportation vehicle parts, used cars, military space program equipment, carpet cushion with recycled foam, medical devices, and used products. It does require a state review starting in January and every 2 years after that the Commissioners of Health and the PCA will review the uses of commercial DECA, the availability of alternatives, and the potential harm to public health and the environment and make appropriate legislative recommendations. And then it does list the exemptions. And it does also have a fee section for the exemption process. And it authorizes the PCA to establish a PBDE-free product labeling program and an awards program. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce Kathleen Schuler, who is going to take us through a brief slideshow about the she's with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. She's going to take us through a brief slideshow that just kind of gives you, in a summary form, all the research about the dangers of these toxic flame retardants. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Schuler. I'm with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. It's a nonprofit in Minneapolis, and I'm a senior policy analyst and a public health scientist with that organization. I'm going to try to go through this quickly because I know you've got kind of a long agenda. Flame retardants obviously serve a useful purpose. They help to prevent and slow the spread of fires. The problem is some flame retardants are creating environmental and public health problems, and these are the flame retardants that we're trying to phase out. Polybrominated diphenyl ethers, as Senator Pappas said, they're very similar to PCBs, which were banned in the 1970s. And even though they were banned so long ago, they're still found in the environment because they're highly persistent. They accumulate in fish, they accumulate in the human body, and they're very toxic. They're globally transported. They become global pollutants. They bind to particles and accumulate in sediments. They are neurotoxic, they're toxic to the brain, and pollution is growing. So like PCBs, brominated flame retardants are becoming a huge problem. There are less toxic alternatives available, and regulation is necessary to reduce this pollution problem. In the U.S., the breast milk in U.S. women contains 10 to 100 times more brominated flame retardants compared with women in Europe, where these flame retardants have been phased out for a few years, particularly the penta and the octa forms. The total PBDE levels in breast milk, blood, and tissues have increased 100-fold during the past 30 years, doubling every 4 years. And the levels in Minnesota fish, sediments, sewage sludge, and wastewater are increasing. This just illustrates the line on the left shows that how PCBs are going down in the environment because of regulation. This is actually data from Sweden, breast milk data from Sweden. We don't have a breast milk monitoring program in the U.S., so we don't have equivalent data. But the brominated flame retardants were going up and increased up through the late 90s. In Sweden, they took action to phase out the flame retardants, and the levels in breast milk started going down. There's three forms, as Senator Pappas said. Yes.
Could you go back to the... I see the axis, or the one that says, would you explain the graph again?
That's PBDE levels, nanograms per gram of fat, and the other axis is the toxic equivalent, picograms per gram of fat, and, of course, the year.
And this is... Mr. Chair, and this is information from Sweden?
Yeah, this is from the Sweden Breast Milk Monitoring Program. And I just present it to show that regulation is effective.
It shows it going down.
Yes.
But then what's the axis that's going up?
That's before they regulated it.
They started regulating it. Many companies in Sweden started phasing it out, and then the levels started going down. Does that help, Senator?
No.
Yeah, you actually have the handout in your packet as well.
How about the...
Go ahead.
Senator Federson.
Senator Dill wants to weigh in on this, too.
Oh, okay, Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair, and to the witness, you explained the line going down, which is kind of interesting. It ends in about 1993 or so. It doesn't go beyond that. But what's the line going up?
It's two different things.
Oh, the line going down, I'm sorry, is PCBs, which were banned in the 1970s. They're chemically similar to the PBDE flame retardants, which were going up and didn't start going down in Sweden until they were regulated and phased out. Does that help, Senator?
This is the PCBs. They started regulating in the 1970s, so it went down. This is the line for the PBDEs, and it's going up until regulation started in 95, and now it's going down. And that's the concentrations in human breast milk.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman,
there's no... Your keys don't support... Don't explain that. You have a diamond, and you have a circle, and the circles are along that one line, but it says nothing... Nothing about that total, whatever total TEQ is.
Yeah, the key is in that little box there. But shall I move on, Mr. Chair and Senator?
I mean, the idea is that once regulation started, then the content of in the human breast milk went down.
That I understand.
Yeah. Sorry for the confusion. So there are three chemical formulations, three commercial formulations, penta, octa, and deca, and it's the number of bromine atoms. Penta and octa are smaller molecules and are therefore more toxic and more available, more bioavailable for the human body to be absorbed. Penta was used in polyurethane foam. Octa was used in plastic housings, and DECA is widely used in plastic TV enclosures, wire and cable applications, and some textiles. The reason we're focusing on DECA mostly is because Chemtura, the only U.S. manufacturer of penta and octa, has now phased it out. Penta and octa are also regulated in the European Union. So they're basically on their way out, even though old furniture could have some of those chemicals. DECA is still widely used. In 2001, its use was estimated at nearly 25,000 metric tons. Even though penta and octa are the most commonly found in the environment, DECA is increasingly being detected. 200 studies conducted around the world found DECA in marine freshwater sediments, air samples in the Arctic, fish, meat, and dairy products, sewage sludge, wildlife, particularly bears, birds, orcas, in house dust, and in human blood and breast milk. The problem with DECA, it's a larger molecule, so it's less toxic than the penta and the octa, but DECA does degrade in the environment into the more toxic forms. 21 studies show that DECA breaks down to lower brominated compounds due to sunlight. Breakdown has been demonstrated in fish, sediment, sewage sludge, and dust. And 9 studies actually mimicked environmental conditions. And they found octa and nona, the lower brominated forms, as DECA breakdown products. And these are persistent bioaccumulative toxins that are now banned in Europe and 8 states. Exposure to DECA is widespread. One study found DECA in the breast milk of 24 of 40 women studied. DECA has been identified in the cord blood of newborn babies. An estimated 5% of American women have levels of PBDEs in their body greater than levels that have been shown to cause reproductive problems in laboratory animals, and that's total PBDEs. That isn't just DECA. The risk to fetuses, infants, and children, of course, are greater. PBDEs do cross the placenta. Infants and children are more susceptible to these toxins because the blood-brain barrier is not fully developed. They have greater intestinal absorption of contaminants, and we know this from lead. The skin is more permeable. They put their hands in their mouth, so they have greater exposure, and they crawl on carpets, so they're more exposed to dust. They receive their mother's toxins through breast milk as well. It's estimated that kids could receive up to 300 times greater exposure to DECA than adults because of breast milk and also exposure to dust. We don't have human data on the toxicity and health effects of DECA, but we do have animal data. In adult mice, DECA-BD8 produced irreversible changes in brain function that worsened with age. So we have data from mammals showing that it's a neurotoxin. DECA was absorbed in newborn mice. Levels in the brain continued to increase in mice exposed only once, suggesting a targeting of the brain for increased uptake. And 10 to 65% of DECA was absorbed from the diet of lab rats. The European Union, to clarify the status of regulation in the European Union, there's an European Union ban on the use of DECA in textiles with dermal contact. Sweden prohibits DECA in textiles. The European Union, I mentioned, has banned penta and octa. There was a DECA phase-out planned, but that has been delayed until 2010. The DECA risk assessment has not completely been finalized. And finally, DECA is now prohibited from electronics in the European Union because of contamination with nona, which is a lower brominated flame retardant. So that's an effective regulation.
Senator Olson.
Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, ma'am, why was the DECA phase-out delayed?
It was delayed because of a decision made by the European Union. There was a lot of lobbying by the companies that make DECA. I don't know ultimately why they made that decision.
Mr. Chairman, are there other equally effective and cost-effective alternatives?
Mr. Sure. Chair, Senator, I'm going to go over that. So, okay, I'll try to... We talked about the toxicity of DECA. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going back.
Wrong way.
The Underwriters Laboratory standards for fire retardancy are the UL-94, are the ones that regulate fire retardancy. There are alternatives that meet these requirements through physically separating the heat-producing elements in a product through the use of naturally flame-retardant materials such as self-extinguishing plastics and through halogen-free chemicals. There are many chemical alternatives to the DECA that are available right now. Washington State estimates that 57% of televisions and 95% of computer products are free of PBDEs. And these are just some examples of the applications that are available. Major companies, computer companies, and TV companies are phasing these out. Motorola uses halogen-free laminate. Toshiba replaced BFR plastic casing with polyphenylene sulfide. And these are just some examples. You actually have a handout on the DECA alternative, so I'll go through these kind of quickly.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, talk about halogen-free. There's a lot of halogen lights lamps today. What's are they dangerous? Are they damaging as well?
Sure. Yeah, the halogenated compounds tend to be more persistent in the environment.
Kind of blinding at night, too.
So there are many televisions sold in Europe cannot have DECA and do not have DECA. So basically in Europe, people can buy a television that doesn't have DECA in it. In the U.S., that's not the case. Many televisions can continue to have DECA. A common flame retardant that's used as a substitute for DECA is RDP or resorcinol bisdiphenyl phosphate. And RDP is a phosphorus-based alternative to DECA. It meets the Underwriters Laboratory V0, which is the highest fire safety standard for televisions. It's not persistent or bioaccumulative per the Washington State Departments of Ecology and Health. The Washington and Maine and Michigan have all conducted studies of alternatives and of a DECA phase-out, and they have recommended a phase-out of DECA BDE. According to the Maine Department of Ecology, they say that RTP presents a significantly lower threat to the environment and human health than DECA BDE. And according to Sopresta, which is one of the companies that makes BDE, RDP is not expected to bioaccumulate and is not considered a persistent bioaccumulative pollutant. Sony says that all virgin plastic presently used by Sony are DECA-free. These products meet all relevant fire safety standards. And for textiles, there are alternatives available as well using inherently flame-resistant fabrics. Stearns & Foster has a product called Flame Guard, and what happens is when there's a flame, it basically just melts instead of igniting. You can use barrier layers, and you can use safer flame retardants. These three state agencies have done extensive studies and have recommended a DECA phase out. In Minnesota, we have support for this as a public health issue from the American Public Health Association, from the Minnesota Public Health Association, from the Minnesota Medical Association, Minnesota Nurses Association, the Learning Disability Association of Minnesota, ARC Greater Twin Cities, and 10 environmental organizations. We are not proposing to alter fire safety standards. We are phasing out DECA in electronic enclosures, textiles, and mattresses for home use. DECA is not widely used in those products, so we'd like to prevent the future use. People spend a lot of time in the home, and that's where they get the greatest exposures. We're not regulating textiles used in institutional settings. We're not regulating wire and cable and transportation uses. This is not a choice between fire safety and protecting the public from toxic flame retardants. We must have fire safety. We just need to use safer alternatives. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we're ready for questions.
What are the exemptions on page 3? Line 22. Saying that the bill
trying to get your last PowerPoint slide. Oh, here it is. Electronic enclosures, textiles for home use, and mattresses. But then on line 22, there's no restriction on the manufacture, import, distribution, transporting products containing PBDL through the state, or storing products in the state for later distribution outside the state. So isn't that kind of a... What do you mean by that? It seems like you could still then store it in the state and then distribute it out of state for sale.
Mr. Chair, I believe that provision refers to the earlier two lines that retailers that are in possession of products that contain the banned flame retardants could continue to sell those.
Until they exhaust their stock. Actually, nothing in this section. The whole section.
Seems like the last three lines are different from lines 18 and 19 in that section. Do you mean for them to be connected? Relate to another?
In this section, so it refers to the whole section. Do you remember why?
No.
Mr. Chair, we're going to need to clarify that particular section.
Okay. Is that something that can be done on the fly, or do we need some wordsmithing time on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, since we can't recall why it's in here,
okay,
we could take it out.
Take it out.
Maybe it got added in the other body, and we picked up the language and didn't notice it.
You're talking about lines 20, 21, 22?
Oh, yeah, it wouldn't have been added in because it's not the amendment. Yeah, it was in the original bill. We're kind of stumped.
All right, let's think about that then.
Yeah. I could see that if you were transporting products and you were going, you know, across a 94 or something.
Yep, I got that part.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Council indicates that that's kind of already protected by the Constitution. We don't necessarily have to say that.
Yeah.
Interstate commerce?
Right, that's what I was thinking.
Mr. Chair, so you don't have to specifically say it, but you can if you want.
I just wanted to try to find out your intent on that.
Yeah.
And then...
I guess it probably was to say we're not trying to violate interstate commerce laws.
Mr. Chair, maybe the storing part meant, you know, staying overnight or something. No. I don't know. I didn't draft it, and I'm not sure what the meaning is. It could be connected to that.
Well, whatever the committee wishes to do on that, we don't have a strong opinion on it.
Okay. And then the part also in the exemptions, the sale or distribution by a business, and then said public entity.
Mr. Chairman.
Charity or private party of any used product. That contains.
Mr. Chairman, did you want to know why I added public entity?
No, I'm just talking about the whole kind of line four. Seems like a general loophole for used products
right.
that have the DECA in it.
It is. It's for used computers so that those could still be used, basically, and the state could still sell them.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right, there were lots of questions. Senator Fredrickson and Senator...
Mr. Chairman, as long as we're on this page 3, lines, line 22, page 3, I'd like to move to delete such and insert the.
And
Mr. Chairman, you read it before without the such in the in the sentence.
You trained me well, Senator.
Where is it?
Page 3,
line 22.
Such. Mr. Chairman, I have no objection to that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fredrickson moves that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Means adopted. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, maybe as a suggestion on the sentence that you have a question about, to bring it in line or to make it consistent with that previous sentence, we could add before the period until their stock is exhausted.
Which line?
Line 22, I'm sorry. After the word state. And then that makes it consistent in the same spirit as the previous sentence. So they can store it, they can move it around, you know, until their stock is exhausted, which is what
Council is suggesting that we just remove those three lines.
That's fine, too.
Mr. Chair.
Mayor Anderson?
It seems to me we ought to hear from the folks that do business with this product to see if there's a reason they want that language
the wrong
in there.
Way.
We really haven't heard why.
Any testimony?
There might be some distributor that moves it across.
Do you have
the
a
state?
Lot of opposition to your...
I don't know, Mr. Chairman. It's the first committee we've been in.
Okay. All right, let's take a couple more questions, and then we'll take some more testimonies. Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr.
Senator
Chair, Robertson. I did want to ask, is there any manufacturer that uses this product in Minnesota that you're aware of?
Yes, sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, there are four companies that use DECA in Minnesota. They don't make it, but they use it in their products.
And Mr. Chair, can you tell us who they are? Are they all? Maybe they're all. They all have lobbyists here who will tell us. But
the RTP company, 3M in New Ulm, Multex, and Strongwell. Those are the four companies that report under the toxic release inventory.
I think we're going to hear from RTP next, Senator Carousel.
Mr. Chairman, my question is about Section 3 on page 3, Commissioner Duties. And we have, it says the commissioner and the commissioner of health. I don't know which the other commissioner it is, but it doesn't matter. But first we've got them reviewing the availability of the use of yada, yada, yada. And then we say the commissioner shall make recommendations to the legislature on additional bans. And then later the commissioner shall report their findings and recommendations. We don't even know yet what we're looking at here tonight instead of projecting out into the future that we're going to give the right of way to make recommendations to commissioners, one of which is unnamed here, but I'm not sure if that's in the front end of the first page.
On page one, the commissioner refers to Pollution PCA. Control Agency right. Commissioner.
But we are going to be having them outlaw something that might even be found not to be too bad in the long run compared to any of his optional alternatives?
Mr. Chair, Senator Parisot, this the duties of the commissioner, the Pollution Control Agency would be the main agency responsible. They would consult with the Department of Health. And this provision goes with the rest of the bill, which is a phase out. It would just require that the Pollution Control Agency research the emerging science and the emerging literature and the information on alternatives. So basically they would just be tracking that issue and making recommendations to the legislature on future policies with respect to brominated flame retardants.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I ask that question about that section is that you told us that these are like PCBs.
Yes.
Like PCBs doesn't tell me anything about what it does to the body. Or for the long-term health, or whether it's accumulated, whether it's shed. You didn't tell me anything about the effects of it on the body, but you just said it's like PCBs, which doesn't tell us very much. But yet we're going ahead to study it and outlaw it without having any scientific evidence about how the effects are on the human body.
Mr. Chair, Senator Parisot, I presented the animal data that we have. With PCBs, we have long-term human studies, so we know that they affect children's development. What we're doing here is we're not waiting for decades of children to get exposed to a neurotoxin. We're saying we know their chemical makeup, and we have animal data to show that they're toxic to the brain, so we're acting more quickly.
Senator Parisot, she also talked about the DECA found in breast milk, identified in cord blood of newborns. 5% of American women have levels of PEDs in their body. So they were referencing the impact on humans.
Mr. Chairman?
I didn't hear anything about symptoms or chronic illnesses or permanent, more than chronic illnesses, debilitating illnesses. Conditions.
Ms. Schuler, do you have any thoughts on
long-term? Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe I could make a comment in that, and I'm not a scientist, but if the scientists have determined that this chemical acts like PCBs and that it's a neurotoxin, it affects the brain, and they've done studies in adult mice that show irreversible changes in brain function that worsen with age. So they have shown negative impacts on mice and on baby mice. So that rather than, since we know we have the animal studies, this appears to be a chemical that acts like PCBs, where we have 40 years of demonstrated damage to humans. Instead of waiting 40 years to see how that same damage develops in humans and using people and children as guinea pigs, it's the wise thing to do to phase it out now. And we found that the European Union is phasing it out, 8 other states have phased it out, and that it accumulates, and it's in the fish, it's in the breast milk already. And we found that in other studies in Sweden that once you regulate it, the levels do start to drop. So we're trying to be proactive here to prevent a massive health damage to people's health before it happens. And it's a very reasonable approach, and that already the research has been done so that there are alternatives that are available that are reasonable alternatives for companies to use. And a lot of the major companies have already phased them out, as she mentioned. So we think this is a very reasonable approach. We're being proactive. We don't want to wait 40 years and have damage done to children that was damaged by lead and PCBs in the past.
And if I might add, Mr. Chair, Senator Pariseau, we regulate mercury in Minnesota because we're concerned about mercury in fish, and we want to make the fish safe so people can eat them. PCBs and brominated flame retardants are also building up in fish, and we'd like to clean up the fish from those contaminants as well.
Mr. Chair.
The PBDEs, they're in computers, is that right?
That's
computer
right.
Computer casings, generally?
DECA is used in electronic enclosures for computers and televisions more commonly.
So how do they get from there to the body?
The fish.
Good question.
Good question. A couple of ways. They get into the household dust. They're degraded by sunlight. They get into the dust. So that's one exposure. Another exposure is through food. Because these flame retardants are so widely used, they get emitted into the environment. They get into the lakes, and they build up in the fish. So we have a global problem, and then we have an exposure within our own homes.
Dust mites. When are we going to outlaw dust mites?
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I have a technical question. On page 3, line 30, the section we're just talking about, there's a word there, non-comestible. Is that supposed to be non-combustible?
Where is it? On page 2?
Page 3, line 30.
Senator Fredrickson, it means non-edible. It's kind of an antiquated word.
Yeah, well.
That's all it means.
Non-edible.
So, Ms. Schuler, it is a word.
It is a word.
There must be a better word for it, though.
Senator Olson.
Couldn't we put something that's understandable if it's going to go into the law?
The public looks it up, they won't know.
I'm informed that staff is going to get a dictionary.
Going to get one.
And it's going to find another word.
Ether. Thank you.
That
you're going to get a dictionary.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. This is a retardant material. Obviously, fires. Firemen have got some concerns about it. Where do they weigh in on this?
Senator Pappas or Ms. Schuler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we have talked with the Minnesota Professional Firefighters Organization, and they are neutral on the bill because we're not changing the standards for fire retardancy. We're just suggesting that safer alternatives be used.
Let's move to Paul Killian and John Onken from RTP. While they're coming up, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, you said it's in computers. Is it in cell phones, too?
Sheila?
DECA is less commonly used in cell phones. I'm not saying that it isn't, but it's a less common use.
So what does that mean?
You can stay here, Kathy. It'd
be dangerous.
You want to just sit over here? You can pull up another chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Killian. I am employed with the RTP company as a market manager.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is John Unken. I'm Vice President of Business Administration for RTP Company.
Who would like to start?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We're here on behalf of the RTP company today and are very concerned about the potential impact Senate File Number 651 proposing a ban of flame retardant dichromodiphenyl ether could have on doing business in our state, and we appreciate the opportunity to submit this testimony to you. Additionally, we stand ready to serve as a resource for the Environment and Natural Resources Committee if we can offer any additional expertise or insight into the possible ramifications of this proposed bill. To give you a bit of background on myself, I've been with the RTP company for 16 years. I've worked in the areas of product development, international business management with our European business, and as a product manager for our flame retardant materials and other products. RTP company is a custom compounder. We work with engineering thermoplastic materials using various additives, including flame retardants like Decabrome, to modify the performance of these materials. We're headquartered in Winona, Minnesota, in the southeast corner of the state, and have 7 manufacturing facilities globally. We provide customized high-performance thermoplastic compounds to injection molding, blow molding, and extrusion industries, who then convert these materials into a wide variety of parts and applications that we see in our everyday life. We've been conducting business in Winona for over 45 years, 25 as an independent company, and an additional 20 years as part of the Fibrite Corporation. We have annual sales of over $250 million, and the Winona headquarters has approximately 400 employees at this site. It's also our development and technology headquarters and Technology and Research Center, and approximately 60% of our employees at this facility are production and hourly type workers. We break our products down into different groups based on performance, and one of our key product groups is flame retardant materials. Flame retardant materials currently represent about 15% of our business, and we have recently identified this product group as one that we specifically would like to grow. The products in this group are modified using additives to meet specific flammability criteria. This criteria can either be defined by voluntary industry specification or a regulatory agency such as UL or factory neutral or industry specification. Decabrome, DBDE or DBBE, is a primary flame retardant additive that we use to meet these specifications. This is due to its compatibility with a variety of plastics and its effectiveness in preventing fires. Decabrome is a white crystalline powder that is mixed and compounded into raw plastics in the molten phase to form a consistent flame-retarded compound. The flame-retardant plastic is then used to manufacture, as I mentioned, a variety of parts and components, including television and computer housings, VCR, DVD housings, and really anything that is associated with electrical current. It's worth mentioning that in our particular business, as an independent compounder, we're not producing resin. We're buying resin from the plastics industry. We pride ourselves in being an independent company, and therefore we make independent material choices and work with over 60 different thermoplastic resins, each one having its own various quirks and idiosyncrasies. Thus, the diversity of our raw material stock is quite broad, and it affects the choices we make on these raw materials. As a compounder, RTP has never been used either penta or octa brominated diphenyl ether, and have no position on the phase-out of those substances. We oppose SF 651 because it rests on the erroneous presumption that decabrome is a harmful material, and because banning of the substance could have a serious detrimental impact on Minnesota's electronics manufacturing sector. It's important also to understand that the phrase PBBE is an acronym for a group of products that consists of three different materials, the penta, the octa, and the deca, as well as some other variations. It was mentioned previously that these chemicals are identified by the saturation of bromine on the molecule. The reason it's important to understand this difference is that the difference in molecular stability is very extreme between the two, and as mentioned, for that reason, RTP has never used penta or octabrome, and the industry has voluntarily phased out production of those materials. Safety is of the utmost importance to RTP, both from the potential human health and environmental effects of the products we use, as well as the fire safety and performance of our materials. With regard to human health and environmental effects of decabrome, we followed the issue closely for many years, going back to the early 90s, and understand that DECA has been rigorously tested in the U.S. and Europe and found to be safe relating to human health and the environment. A 10-year-long risk assessment conducted by the European Union examined 588 studies covering a wide range of potential human health and environmental concerns and did not identify any health or environmental risks in need of further regulation, leading directly to the decision of the European Commission to exempt decabrome from the Regulation of Hazardous Substance Directive in October of 2005, and that other independent studies also confirm that decabrome can be used in consumer products without concerns for health, including the U.S. National Academy of Sciences review of decabrome, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, decabrome risk assessment, the U.K. Department of Trade and Industry, risk and benefits in the use of flame retardants, and the California Senate Office of Research reports on PBDEs. It's also worth noting that in formulating our products, RTP has evaluated many of the raw materials and chemicals that are listed as proposed alternates. And it's very true that there are different types of FR systems that are used in different types of materials. In fact, in most situations where there is an alternate technology, industry has gravitated or naturally or voluntarily gone the route of alternate materials. In the products where decabrome is currently used, particularly in our product line, there are not viable economical alternatives. There are different systems that can be used, but they don't produce the same compound and they don't meet the same technical requirements in the application. We've spent many, many years examining these technologies, including the non-halogenated systems and alternate brominated FR products. We also note that there are no bans on decabrome in any other state in the United States, and less than 2 months ago, the Maryland Department of the Environment finalized a comprehensive review of decabrome, concluding that decabrome should not be banned unless safer alternatives are identified and or new toxicology data shows that there is an unacceptable risk to public health and the environment. RTP is also very concerned with the economic ramifications of a decabrome ban to the RTP company and to the state of Minnesota. It was mentioned previously that there are four companies using decabrome into their products, but that fails to explain the structure of the injection molding and extrusion industry within the state. RTP is putting the decabrome into thermoplastic materials. We sell product to at least 15 injection molders in the state of Minnesota, and the Thomas Registry identifies over 85 plus molders in the state. So it's affecting not just one single compounder, but you're taking on a whole level of processors. By banning this material in this state, you're not going to prevent the use of the decabrome. You'll drive the manufacturing to areas where it's not regulated.
Mr. Killian, there was a statement given to us from Sony. All virgin plastic presently used by Sony are DECA-free. These products meet all relevant fire safety standards. Is this accurate to your knowledge?
I cannot speak, Mr. Chairman, for Sony. and I would not want to do so. The use of the term virgin materials to RTP company is a bit misleading because we're not quite sure what they mean by that. We think of a virgin material as being an unmodified resin that we would buy from a supplier. It's difficult for me to really understand what that quote is getting at.
Is that substance DECA-free that you use, that you just described?
Mr. Chairman, could you repeat your question, please?
The virgin plastic that you said that it refers to.
Virgin plastic could refer to unmodified polypropylene, which when burned will burn very aggressively and very rapidly and has a high amount of energy to release. Or it could refer to what we refer to as high-temperature materials, such as PPS, which I saw reference to in one of the slides, which is inherently flame retardant. The difference between those materials, first and foremost, is cost. Polypropylene is 50 cents a pound, and PPS is in excess of $5 a pound, and there are other more expensive resins. So technology or technical requirements of an application are going to dictate what kind of resins are used and thus the systems involved.
So you could use virgin plastic that was DECA-free, but it would cost more.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'll pick up and just finish my statement. I mentioned we're very concerned with the economic ramifications. A ban in Minnesota will lead to relocation of production of these compounds to other facilities, resulting in a shift of jobs to another state or country. Additionally, many members of the industry to which we supply decabrome-containing compounds, including the plastics injection molding, blow molding, and extrusion companies, are located here in Minnesota. These Minnesota-based companies and facilities would lose jobs to other states or countries where the use of this material is not restricted. The result would be loss of jobs, revenue, and taxes in Minnesota. We're also very concerned with fire safety. The use of flame retardant systems and plastics is for one reason: increased fire safety. Restriction on flame retardant systems with no viable alternates will lead to reduction in fire safety. The use of flame retardants in plastics in which Decabrome is most often used is voluntary. There are no federal or state fire safety standards for most consumer electronics. UL 94 is not necessarily a mandatory regulation. The power of the market drives that. Despite the fact that that electronics made of highly flammable plastics generally contain high-voltage circuitry that can become significant heat sources, Decabrome has become the flame retardant of choice in certain electronic applications because it is easy to use, highly effective, and cost-efficient. As such, eliminating Decabrome and forcing the use of products that are harder to use, less effective, and more costly could very likely lead to the removal of flame retardants altogether, resulting in more fires and more unnecessary injury or deaths at the consumer level. Finally, we'd like to address the issue of alternates, and I've touched on this already. In some compounds, alternate technologies may exist. For others, there are not substitutes. It is not a flat across-the-board statement to say that there are other technologies that provide the same flame retardant properties. What is certain is there are no systems that provide the same combination of safety and economics, nor are there currently any alternatives that have gone through the extensive human safety environmental testing that Decabrome has been through. There's no plug-in alternative to Decabrome, and it is not possible to simply switch one type of flame retardant for another in a resin mixture and have a plastic with the same performance and flame retardant quality. Manufacturers seeking to use alternate flame retardant in plastics are generally required to change the type of plastic they use to use a larger amount of the alternative flame retardant to provide an equivalent level of fire protection, and to use alternative flame retardants about which much less is known concerning the long-term safety effects on humans and in the environment. And from my own experience in formulating these materials, as we have researched and looked into alternative chemistries, we're very often, in all cases, talking about new technologies that not only are less tested, but less stable, less compatible with the materials, and less compatibility with material then results in the potential for these materials coming out. Something like Decabrome, which is extremely compatible with plastic materials, is very very compatible in the encapsulated polymeric state. Other alternative materials don't always provide that same kind of compatibility. In summary, I'd like to stress several points. RTP supports any effort to review and ensure the health and environmental safety of any of the variety of raw materials we use in our manufacturing process. In order to have an accurate view of this issue, sound scientific data and an impartial review are necessary. This scientific data has shown that decabrome does not pose added risk to humans or the environment. In Minnesota, economic ramifications still are significant, and a clear understanding of the economic impact is necessary. RTP has followed this issue for many years and has a close working relationship with the flame retardant industry and related industry groups. We want to offer to you and your colleagues our knowledge and experience as well as provide access to all industry information. We're happy to answer any questions that the committee will have.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Mr. Killian?
Yes.
Yes. The end products that your material goes into through the injection molding, those are fairly rigid products. One of the frames here talked about children getting it through dust. Do these products actually shed dust that would have this material in it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we would refer to the studies done in Europe on this issue. We have not conducted formal dusting studies of our materials. However, in our evaluation of various materials, we have determined and been backed up by industry information that decabrome is the most stable and compatible in the resins that we use it in. I don't know if I answered your question directly.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was thinking of that end product.
Mm-hmm.
Do those kinds of materials generally shed dust? I mean, you could see them if they in fact burn, giving off materials, but you're trying to prevent burning.
Correct.
So that isn't what was happening. I was just trying to think of how, you know,
put the material,
if it's a computer frame or if it's any other kind of material that is a firm, hard material, how that would shed so that you get dust in carpets and stuff that the children would pick up, would that? Or is that may be coming from some other product, but would it be coming from the kind of product that you're manufacturing, or that you are coming from the products that are manufactured from the material that you provide?
We do not believe so. We are encapsulating the material into a polymeric seal, if you will. We put it through an extrusion process where the material is put into molten polymer. So when the injection molded parts come out, the flame retardant is encapsulated inside polymer. How a material stays in a polymer has to do with the form it's in, and this material as a white powder is very compatible and secure within that polymer casing.
Thank you.
Okay, Laura Ruiz.
Excuse me.
Ruiz. We got another.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I just had a point to make.
Sorry. And we've spent a lot of time with RTP. Could you summarize, please?
Just very quickly, if I could. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I just wanted to make it clear, not only do we use the decabrome in our products here in the U.S. and throughout our operations in other states, but we also use it in Europe. We've continued to use it. It's sold throughout the European community. Our France operation manufactures with decabrome as a flame retardant, and it's completely acceptable over there. The other thing we'd like to make sure that is clear is that we want to stay as healthy as anyone else, and we followed these studies for years to make sure that we're providing a healthy and environmentally safe product as well. And through all the testing that's been conducted, there's no evidence that decabrome provides anything but a healthy and clean environment. There are no studies that disprove that.
The Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy states that DECA is now prohibited from electronics in the European Union. Is that, do you agree?
Mr. Chairman, to our knowledge, decabrome was exempted from the ROHS directive in the EU. There was a controversy that perhaps Laura Ruiz can speak to better than I can related to contaminant congeners which are present from the manufacturing process. To our knowledge, RTP company, the material was exempted from the ban.
All right, Laura Ruiz. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
The PowerPoints. Chair, if you'll please bear with me here. This is highly technical. Mr. Chairman, while she's getting set up, in your packet, there's a Getting the Facts Straight on DECA BDE handout, and it cites all the studies, 14 listed here, that that talk about the dangers of DECA. And it's also, interestingly enough, RTP company actually makes non-halogenated flame retardants, and in some of their handouts, where's the one? They kind of brag that it's a bromide chlorine heavy metal free materials that meet global substance restrictions and that are environmentally friendly worldwide. So they do make these, they use DECA in some of their applications, but evidently they've been a leader in developing non-halogenated flame retardant components that meet EU requirements. Coming back to that.
Mr. Chair, may I just respond? What was just stated is absolutely correct. We do, I think I, in my testimony, stated that we work with all sorts of raw materials, including non-halogenated and alternate brominated FR. So it is a fair statement to say that we do produce those compounds. And the marketplace has used them where they've deemed them appropriate. It's also interesting to note that the sales we have under that product line is nowhere near what we have with the Decabrol, not by our doing, but by the market.
Mr. Chairman?
All right, we're kind of...
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say one more thing, then we'll go on to her, okay? Right. One thing, quick.
Okay,
I wanted to point out that in the amendment and in the original bill, there is an exemption process. We're trying to be sensitive to local businesses, so they could, if there was no economically practical or commercially available alternative, apply for an exemption with the commissioner.
Mr. Chairman,
I just think that if it's really a dangerous product, then why are we exempting it at all? Don't make things that poison people. Otherwise, don't have a ban. If we're going to exempt everyone in the kitchen sink, why are we even trying it? Let's prove up the danger, the impact, and really ban it. It seems like the European Union has done quite a bit. There's some disagreement as to the extent, but that's just my feelings on it. Ms. Ruiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Laura Ruiz, and I'm here today to represent the Bromine Science and Environmental Forum. And I would like to testify on behalf of some concerns I have for several of the conditions called out in Senate File 651. The issue I believe we have in front of us today is one of balance in looking at the risk and consequences from fire, which is what the flame retardant is put there to protect us from to begin with, balanced with the potential or perceived human harm or environmental effects. And I think throughout this discussion, I'll be looking at how we look at risk associated with either of these two incidents and how we keep that balanced. Why do we use flame retardants to begin with? This picture illustrates what happens to a room in just 3 minutes when it is completely engulfed in flames and the contents of the room are made of combustible products. The fire facts.
Question real quick. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'm interrupting too soon, but I'm just curious why we're talking about fire safety now if, I mean, what in the legislation before us compromises fire safety.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'd like to address that later on in the presentation as one possible alternative that would put fire safety at risk, if I may.
We'll see.
I think the fire facts in the U.S. speak for themselves. Every year there are still in the U.S. over 4,000 civilians killed each year from fire. In Minnesota, that death rate is 40 civilian injuries of 148 civilian and property losses nearly a half a million each day. The reason flame retardants are put in products to begin with is they prevent or slow the spread of fire, allowing occupants in a room such as the one on the right-hand side of this chart up to 15 times more time to get out of that room. They also serve to protect our firefighters and allow them more time to save the occupants of the room. Decabrome, as we've heard already, is used in a variety of end-use applications, not just those that are called out for in this bill. They're used in wire and cable, appliances, switches, automotive, in addition to textiles and electronic enclosures. What you will hear about DECA is that it is one of the highest volume commercial flame retardants used. This is true. The reason that it is used so widely is because of its ease in application and handling. It is a white powder, which makes it very easy to blend in with some of the formulations that it is compatible with. You will also hear that reported findings of PBDEs are often misrepresented as DECA, and I will ask you if when you start hearing data that talks about findings in the environment to ask specifically, are we talking about DECA or are we talking about the whole class of PBDEs? Because not all PBDEs are the same. DECA can be found in the environment. We've heard many times, and this is true, and we're doing a lot to address that concern, and I think that's why we're here having this discussion. DECA degrades to more toxic forms in the environment. This is false, and I'll give you the information that will prove so. The EU has already restricted use of DECA in electronics. This simply is not true, and I'll give you more data on that point. And companies have found safer substitutes to DECA. False. So let me continue, and I'll explain a little more about each of these points. What you should know about DECA is that it is a proven and cost-effective flame retardant. Again, it's easy and safe to handle. It's highly effective, which means you can use less. Many of the alternatives you'll hear about, you have to load up in the resin to get the same fire rating of V0. You have to put much more of that product in there. The reason that DECA has become so effective and has been used for over 30 years with an excellent track record is that its cost effectiveness and availability have actually driven fire safety standards where they're not mandatory. It has allowed manufacturers of products such as TVs and electronics and textiles to put fire safety in their products when they didn't have to. And that's extremely important, I think, from a fire safety point of view. The product is stable. Others will say it's persistent. That is not always a bad thing. When you're talking about flame retardancy and having that product stay in there year after year in your furniture and your computer, you don't want to come up 10 years from now with a fire in your house and wonder if it's still there. It's persistent. It's stable. It's chemically distinct from any other PBDE. We've heard Penta, we've heard Okta. This is DECA. It's chemically distinct. Penta and Okta had issues with their profile. They went through the same risk assessment as DECA. Those two products were voluntarily removed from the market by the only producer of those two products. DECA survived. Why? Because it had the science to back it up. Its manufacture and use is covered by an industry-wide regulatory-endorsed emissions control program. Again, we don't want DECA in the environment. It shouldn't be there. It shouldn't be found all over, as you've heard today it might be. What we should be doing is focusing on how to keep emissions down and how to remove any type of emissions from this product out of the environment. And I'll explain what we're doing about that. It is the most studied flame retardant on the market. It's accepted for continued use, not only in the U.S. by REPA and Consumer Product Safety Commission, but also in the European Union. I want to talk a little bit about the definition of safer, because we've heard here already that there are safer alternatives that manufacturers have already switched to these safer alternatives. When you talk about any alternative, you need to ask, does that alternative provide equivalent fire protection in the same application at the same or reduced amounts? Does it, or the process to make it, or the raw materials that go into it, create any additional concerns for the environment or the personnel that have to handle that? Has it gone through an equivalent battery of testing for human health and environmental impacts? How does that alternative perform at the end of its useful life? We have done numerous studies on Decabrome as part of the EU risk assessment and shown that this product can be safely recycled for up to 5 or 6 cycles without any loss of properties whatsoever in terms of flame retardancy. Is there an emissions control program in use for any alternative we're talking about to keep those emissions out of the environment? And if you look at the number of studies, you can clearly see a comparison of the number of scientific analyses done on DECA far outweighs any of the other alternatives that might potentially be considered. The one we heard about tonight is, I believe, 7 lines down, the RDP product, which is the red bar, 7 spaces down. And I'll talk more about that one. So here it is, the difference, Decabrome versus RDP, which is the one suggested alternative that we've heard already. In terms of bioconcentration or its ability to accumulate, look at the difference. Obviously, the lower the number, the better. Chronic aquatic toxicity hazard, very high for RDP. In fact, it's high enough that in Europe, if you get this product in Europe, it has to be designated with R phrases, which basically an R5253 phrase means that it may cause long-term adverse effects in the aquatic environment and it must be labeled. Because of that, transportation regulates that this product be classified as an environmentally hazardous substance, and it is identified as containing dangerous components. Resorcinol diphosphate, RDP, is a liquid. I don't know if everybody's aware of that. So we're talking about an alternative that is physically, distinctly different than DECA, which is a white powder, which we know a lot about and we've learned to handle quite safely. DECA is not classified as either toxic, hazardous, or as having dangerous components by the EU, the US, or any other country. The science shows, and it backs up these statements that I'm making. The EU itself has completed a risk assessment, which is one of the most comprehensive assessments of a chemical's impact on human health and the environment. For over 10 years, these studies went on, over 588 studies, and we're still studying. And the conclusion showed clearly no risk to human health or the environment, no need for further risk reduction measures like restrictions or bans, and no restriction, obviously, I just mentioned, and continued monitoring could be put in place to assure the EU that this product could be safely used. And other studies have been done, not just in the EU. The U.S. National Academy of Sciences reviewed DECA in 2000. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission ran a risk assessment on DECA both in 2001 and again in 2006 as they sought to put in place a national fire safety standard for upholstered furniture and mattresses. The UK Institute of Occupational Medicine looked at it in 2003. The UK Department of Trade and Industry in 2005. Japan had their own risk assessment on the product in 2005. The California State Senate of Office Research in 2005. And the Maryland Department of Environmental Protection in 2006. So we're not talking about old, outdated studies. The EU risk assessment was finalized in 2004, and we're still studying DECA. Let me talk a little bit about degradation. This is an issue that comes up, questions come up about debromination, findings of pentanoctin in the environment as they come from the perceived breakdown of DECA. The fact is that DECA can be forced to degrade in laboratory settings and under conditions not likely to occur in normal use. And what I mean by that is that typically in a laboratory setting, there is the addition of certain bacteria, microbes, or accelerants to cause a more rapid rate of degradation. What happens, though, is this pattern of pentanocta formed in the laboratory looks nothing like what's being found in the environment. Those patterns are completely different. After reviewing all of the available data on this issue, the EU went back, after the risk assessment was concluded, they went back and looked at new data that had been put forward and still summarized that all of that data didn't change their conclusions and provided little evidence for debromination being a significant source of a degradation to a lower pentanocta type species.
Does DECA bind to particles and accumulate in sediments?
Does DECA has been found in the sediment, yes.
Does it bind to particles?
I'm not quite sure what that means in terms of binding to the particles, but that's where some of these studies have found DECA is in sediment, yes.
Is DECA neurotoxic?
No. That was studied in the 588 studies, and only one study looked at neurotoxicity, and that study by Viberg is in question.
The EU banned the use of DECA in textiles with dermal contact.
I am not aware that the EU has banned DECA anywhere.
Has Sweden prohibited DECA use in textiles?
There is a one action by Sweden that is in contest by the EU. It's not for the same restrictions spelled out in the ROS. It's outside electronics.
Thank you.
I will add that we've heard tonight that there are 21 or 22 independent studies that have been done on degradation on this particular issue. The majority of those studies were re-reviewed when the European Union took another look through August of 2005 and made this conclusion that whether it was found in sediment or sludge or wherever, it was not of significant concern. I will tell you that four of the debromination studies that were cited in the packet of 22 took place after the EU review in 2006. And many of those were conducted by a scientist by the name of Heather Stapleton. And we've reviewed these studies, and they do not change the fundamental conclusions that have been made already, that the laboratory studies indicating degradation do not reflect what's really happening in the environment. Furthermore, this is a very difficult issue, and it's difficult to summarize, but I think Heather Stapleton herself summarized in her own words in her report to the EPHA Environmental Network in May of 2006. And this is a group, an environmental NGO, who funded a literature review released by Dr. Stapleton. And her words exactly were, of particular concern in human and environmental samples is the accumulation of the lower brominated congeners, tetra, penta, or hexa, BDEs. And based on the current data available, the potential for significant formation of these congeners in the environment due to debromination is low. The only studies demonstrating formation or production of these congeners from debromination occurred when DECA was dissolved in organic solvents and exposed to sunlight and or UV sources, which is not environmentally relevant. These are the words of the scientist who is cited in the 22 studies. After the EU review.
We should probably start summarizing, Ms. Ruiz.
Pardon?
We should probably start summarizing your testimony.
Let me go to the most recent studies that we have on this particular issue. In Maryland, the Department of Environment recently in 2006 concluded that DECA should not be banned unless safer alternatives are identified and or new toxicological data shows that there is an unacceptable risk to public health and or the environment. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission concluded in 2006 that DECA does not pose a risk for use. And the U.S. EPA project plan for PBDEs, which was issued in May of 2006, indicates that they are following the issue closely and playing a substantial role in the research of DECA, that DECA is not subject to the restrictions that have been adopted for PENA and OCTA, and it was exempted from a list of prohibited chemicals by the EU in October of 2005, and this statement is contained in their report of May 2006. The exemption in the EU is still very much in place today, and DECA, as you've already heard, is used in Europe. To the point that was made earlier on fire safety and why I bring this up, one alternative that is not often discussed is the alternative of using nothing. And I mentioned already that fire safety standards in many cases are not mandatory. They're voluntary. In the U.S., the UL standards are voluntary. Where you have a lot of consumer electronics dependent on flame retardants for fire safety, there are manufacturers, and we know this because we've gone on the shelves and we found these products, who are removing flame retardants altogether. If you take one of the most cost-effective products off the market, this trend could escalate. So my conclusions are that chemical flame retardants are important in terms of fire safety. DECA is the most studied flame retardant available for all the applications where it fits, and it does not pose added risk to humans, firefighters, or the environment. The human environmental impacts of alternatives, I think we can say, is unclear at best. And no other state has banned DECA. So with a 30-year track record on its use and a proven technology for fire safety, you look at alternatives with many, many more unknowns, and I ask, what additional risks would we be introducing with a ban on DECA?
Questions for the witness. Senator Scogin.
Well, I'm a little confused, I guess. You say that DECA is found in the environment, yet you say that under normal environmental conditions it doesn't break down. However, Ms. Schuler told us that it does. So do you have documentation that it doesn't?
We have studies that show that sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator. We have studies that show that it can be forced to break down, but that what you're finding in the environment is more than likely from the natural forms of PENA and OCTA themselves, not from breakdown of DECA. It's the species are two different chemicals.
Follow up, if DECA is different from the other two and it's not breaking down through normal environmental procedures, how is it getting in there? How is it getting in the environment?
Ms. Ruiz.
Mr. Chair, Senator, DECA is getting in the environment more than likely from emissions that are in the manufacturing cycle or the use or formulation cycle. And as I mentioned before, these are emissions that the industry voluntarily has put a program around to reduce and eliminate. The point is the levels found in the environment are extremely low, and the risk associated with those levels has to be assessed and understood. And there is nothing today after all of these studies that shows there is any risk associated with these small levels of DECA in the environment. Most of the levels we're finding of PBDEs are from the products Penta and Octa, which were used in upholstered furniture and some in electronics. Octa was used in electronics.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to thank Ms. Ruiz for what I consider a very good testimony. I've listened carefully to all the testimony, and I was taken by the position that the European Union has taken on this after 558 studies. I think you said 588 at one time, but
yes,
I think
sir.
The slide said 558, or did I see that wrong? At any rate, a lot of studies that showed no risk to the health and the environment, and that the suggested alternative to DECA is RDP. It does have some chronic aquatic toxicity problems. And I was also impressed by the information that no other state in the United States has banned it. And there seems to be numerous studies, very recent studies, that suggest it's not that big a problem. Now, one thing I think is a little confusing here, and what I usually say in a situation like this is that almost anything can be toxic, but it's the dose that makes it toxic. I know, Mr. Chair, you had mentioned earlier that if there's something toxic that we're manufacturing, we should try to get rid of it. But the fact of the matter is that almost anything is toxic at a particular dose, and this appears to be a chemical that has very low prevalence in the environment. And so I'm convinced by the testimony, at least I've heard so far, is that it would not be appropriate to pass this bill.
Hey, Senator Pappas and
Mr. Schuller. Chairman, I think we should just give Ms. Schuller a few minutes to refute some of the claims by the opponent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we don't want to get into dueling science here, but I have a few documents that would contradict some of the things that Ms. Ruiz said. I have a letter from the European Commission saying that DECA is restricted on the European market because it's contaminated with Nona BDE, which is already banned. I have a summary of the scientific studies on accumulation and debromination of DECA BDE by Dr. Heather Stapleton.
Donovan, why don't you grab that letter and at least pass it around if there aren't enough
saying
copies.
That DECA does debrominate and that the compounds that are found in the environment are not contaminants from the DECA. They're not from Penta in the environment. They are actually breakdown products, and they've proven that. So, and that it is widely found in the environment. I also have Supresta is one of the companies that makes RDP, and Supresta has said that RDP is not acutely toxic to fish and other other insects, and that it is not anticipated to bioaccumulate in the environment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you. Just while we have both of you sitting there, has the European Commission or has it not banned DECA?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I have a letter from the European Union, and the very last paragraph says, please note that this opinion of the Commission services is not legally binding. The DECA-BROME exemption still stands.
Senator Scogin, that exemption is until 2010, and that letter is effectively restricting DECA on the European market because of contamination.
Mr. Chair, that is not true. And DECA is still being widely used in Europe, as you've heard the testimony from RDP. I'm sorry, RTP.
Well, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Why don't we let Ms. Schuller continue on with her response?
Well, I think I've pretty much covered most of the issues. You have the facts on DECA BDE in your packet. Are there any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator
I
Anderson.
Thought I heard Ms. Ruiz just directly contradict Ms. Schuller about what the European Union has said and
said she had a letter too.
Yes, I do.
Can we compare those two letters?
It's the same letter, just the...
It's the same letter?
It's just the last paragraph she was referencing.
Okay, so we just have to interpret it.
Question for Ms. Schuller on your letter. Do you have an extra copy of it up there?
Did
you borrow yours for
something? Submitted the letter, yeah.
On the fourth paragraph... The Commission Services are of the opinion that, with the exception of DECA BDE, all
PBDEs, including non-PBDE, as introduced into a material as part of DECA BDE, have to comply with the substance ban of Article 4 of the directive, with the maximum tolerance level set by the decision. So it says all PBDEs, with the exception of DECA, are part of the ban. Is that your interpretation of that paragraph?
That particular paragraph is basically saying that even though DECA is exempted from the Ross Agreement on Hazardous Substances, because it's contaminated with NONA, exceeding the 0.1% threshold, therefore it's restricted in electronics. So obviously we're reading this very differently. But
okay. All right. Further discussion on Senate File 651.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I'd just like to ask Ms. Ruiz what organization she speaks on behalf of. You had it like a logo up on the screen
there.
What is that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's the Bromine Science and Environmental Forum. It's made up of the major manufacturers of brominated flame retardants. It's Albemarle Corporation, Chemtura, and Israeli Chemicals Limited, or used to be Dead Sea Bromine.
Dead Sea Bromine.
That's a terrible name, sorry. That's not my company.
I wasn't going to say anything. Senator Olson.
Is it found in the Dead Sea? Is that where they
Yes, it is. That's a very, very important source. Yes.
Oh, interesting.
I thought it created the Dead Sea. That's why. Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, do we know if the MPCA or the Department of Health or any other unit of the state government or federal government is recommending that this legislation pass?
Senator Pappas or Ms. Schuller?
I had mentioned that there were three states that issued reports. They did a complete review of the science. That is Michigan, Maine, and Washington, and all three states have recommended a DECA phase-out. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency did a paper on polybrominated diphenyl ethers in 2005, and they said that they considered it a problem and that it does debrominate in the environment. But I don't want to speak for the PCA. I believe they're here.
Does department want to say anything on this? All right, Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, for what it's worth, I have swam in the Dead Sea, and I'm still here living.
Okay. We are glad.
Mr. Chair, Senator, you probably floated in the Dead Sea instead of swam.
It's a salty sea.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
The PCA is coming. Okay,
yep.
Never mind. I'll let them
speak. Mr. Chair of the committee, I'm Marvin Hora with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Sir, could you give me your name again?
Marvin Hora.
Marvin Hora.
H-O-R-A.
Okay, thank you. Does the department have any thoughts on this bill?
The agency is remaining neutral on the bill. We also have concerns on the degradation of DECA in the environment. There's a large volume of that material out there. Basically our agency works with a product stewardship approach, and we prefer to have the product voluntarily reduced or removed from the environment, but on the bill remaining neutral.
What does that large volume of data say?
There's a large volume of the material itself.
Oh.
DECA is, as everyone said, the number one amount used in it. So there's a reservoir material out there.
Has PCA studied DECA or PBDEs?
We have done some sampling of PBDEs in the environment. Primarily in fish, we have found the lower brominated materials in fish in the Mississippi River. So PBDs are out there. They're spread out pretty much all over the world. The DECA is we've found that in the Minnesota environment, but particularly the concern rests with the penta and the octa, the lower brominated.
Is BCA aware of human impacts or potential human impacts of DECA?
No.
Has it attempted to be aware?
No, we haven't. We haven't done any of the research into it. We would, request the Department of Health to do their. They're the people, the toxicologists and the people who evaluate those chemicals, and we would defer to them and their toxicological expertise.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I think I heard Ms. Schuler and now the witness say that there's concern that DECA in and of itself may not be a concern. The fact that it's out in the environment and breaks down into those other components is of concern. Did I hear that correctly?
There are basically two controversies that are around DECA. One is the safety of the alternatives, both for fire retardants and for environmental impacts. And the second controversy that swirls around the chemical is whether it itself degrades in the environment. Most of the concerns on the environmental side and the concern that the agency would have would be that the chemical could degrade into lower brominated, more toxic materials.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I thought I heard that it was quite stable and there was not that breakdown, but I'm interested in, from the company that we heard testimony, Mr. Killian, perhaps you could answer, are you aware of what in your product the level of NONA BDE is by weight? Do you have...
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the amount of NONA in the Decabrome that we buy would be the assay we receive from our suppliers. I don't know it specifically from the top of my head, but it's information that we have provided to us by our suppliers. I believe it's roughly in the range of 2 to 3% of the overall composition of the flame retardant, not into our product. We're using the flame retardant then at various levels into our compounds.
Senator Pappas, and then I think we should get some resolution to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I know that the science can be confusing, so I would suggest that the committee relies on the supporters of the legislation. The Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy is a nonprofit and independent body. Ms. Schuler is a scientist, a public health scientist. Organizations supporting the phase-out of DECA include public health organizations, the medical association, the nurses, environmental groups. Whereas the witness represents the industry, basically the people who manufacture this product, who, although it's a phase-out and there's exceptions and we're trying to be sensitive to their financial bottom line, it's still the manufacturers of this toxic product that are resisting the phase-out. I don't hear independent scientists coming in here and telling us that, this is a safe product, we don't need to phase it out. And I really don't want us to make the same mistakes that we made with PCBs and have this take 40 years before we finally, after seeing the damage to our children, decide to phase it out.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, would you be interested in having your bill apply the prohibition applied to penta and octa, and then have the Commissioner of PCA and Health do a study for us and come back and report to us on DECA? Because I sense among committee members some reluctance relating to DECA because of the conflicting testimony we've heard today or tonight.
Mr. Chairman, the committee will do what the committee will do, but it's not surprising that the manufacturers of DECA and those who use the product, if it's an inexpensive product as opposed to a safer product that's more expensive, would be in opposition. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't do what's right in terms of the public interest. And I think it's time. We have a two-year delay. We could delay that a couple more years. But basically, Penta and Okta have been phased out. I mean, there's no controversy over them whatsoever. So we're really not accomplishing much if we just do the Penta and the Okta. The concern is really the DECA.
Senator Ingridson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one comment. We do use the PCA for information, and when the red light doesn't go on for them, and they stand neutral, I guess I have to concur with Mr. Senator Dill that I don't think we should move this bill past this committee. Just a comment. Thanks.
The bill has to go to finance, I believe, if we agree to pass it out. Is that correct?
Commerce.
Okay. You want to make a motion?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, before we do that, I just wanted to ask Senator Frederickson if we, on 228, we delayed the phase out. We have asked the PCA to do a review, a health review, and that would give them time to do the review before it actually is, you know, kind of the drop dead date. And if they come back with different information, which is unlikely, but if they did, we'd be able to change that. So we could delay that until 2012 if people thought that would be more reasonable. And members would be willing to send it out with that provision.
Well, it seems like the commissioner's study of this is one of the most important parts of your bill. I was a little concerned that PCA has no information, nor have they sought it. That was,
well, Mr. Chair.
Strange. So, I like the fact that they should be starting to investigate this. Senator Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would especially, I'd add to that the Commissioner of Health, who I assume I don't even know if there's anyone here from the Health Department, but, you know, PCA said they're paying attention to the environmental degradation of this compound, but not human health, but the health department's job in particular is to pay attention to that, and we have no idea whether they have a concern about it or not, but they certainly ought to be looking at it given that there's concern around the world on this substance.
And that's what Section 3 does. Mm-hmm. Senator Frederickson?
Mr. Chairman, as a result of Senator Pappas' remarks about possibly delaying this to 2012, on page 2, line 28, I would move to delete 2010 and insert 2012. I think that will give additional time to make sure that there is a thorough review and study, and would hope give some comfort to the manufacturers and employers in our state that are using this, that it'll be a very careful and deliberative study.
Did you move that?
Yes.
Okay. Discussion, Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I grabbed a copy of it, and I just quickly glanced through the PCA's communication and their background paper, and they do articulate some concern about, you know, PBDEs in general, and encouraging less use of them, and they do go on to talk about how DECA breaks down in the environment, also breaks down in our bodies and may indeed cause the health problems that we're all concerned about with the other compounds. So, you know, I think the PCA is indicating to us there's a significant cause for concern here.
Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry. We have the amendment. On the Frederickson amendment, seeing no other discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Olson? Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, I had a question back earlier when we were talking about the source of these studies. I don't know anything about the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. What are its sources of funding?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy is a nonprofit, and we receive funding from foundations. We don't have a membership base.
Name some of them.
Can you identify some of those, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Shuler?
Some of the funding that we have to work on the brominated flame retardants is from the Environmental Health Fund. We have funding from Belden and John Merck. Those are the most relevant grants that we have.
Thank you.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask staff if it would work to pass Section 3 only, delete Sections 1, 2, 4, and that's it. So I asked Mr. Knopf or Mr. Baker, would the bill still work if we just pass Section 3?
Council says that Section 3 would still work if the other sections were deleted.
Well, then, Mr. Chair,
bill itself would have a hard time working since you deleted most of it.
Mr. Chair,
Baker.
There's just one little line on the last line, 4.10. The amendment changed it to refer to an exemption under Section 2, Sub 3. So, we could just delete that. This was added by the amendment that Senator Pappas put on at the very beginning.
Okay.
And so that would stand, that wouldn't make any sense if we just passed through, but we could get rid of that. I mean, that's the only thing I can see just
we need
looking
to
at
add,
it right now.
We need to add language on 410?
No, we would delete language. We would delete, because the bill was amended to add the words at the, after on line 4.10 before the period, unless exempted under Section 2, Sub 3, or Section 4, Sub 1.
Okay.
So
it's added with the amendment.
Delete that, and then that would make that sentence read. I'll just read the sentence because the amendment changed it a little bit earlier. Starting up on 4.5. Line 4.5, sub 3, state procurement. By January 1st, 2008, the Commissioner of Administration shall make available for purchase and use by all state agencies only equipment, supplies, and other products that do not contain polybrominated diphenyl ethers. So you might want to take that whole sub 3 out. That's the way it would read as amended by the amendment we put on it earlier.
That's
that kind of goes against the
pretty deleted one.
Just having the study, because it actually says the state has to get rid of it, you know, well, not purchase anything.
You're saying if we do the...
If we do Section 3,
okay.
Sub 1
all
and
right,
Sub
right.
2...
If we just do the study, we're going to have to delete Subdivision 3 from that study.
Well, Mr. Chair,
we haven't
you
done,
don't
we haven't
have
done
to.
That yet.
That's the committee's decision.
Right, right, right.
We haven't done
right.
that yet.
I'm.
Yeah.
That's a policy question.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. I'm not recommending that. I'm just saying you want to make sure you know the meaning of it.
Correct. Okay. Further discussion. Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I think I'd like to move to delete the entire bill except Section 3, probably Subdivision 1. Subdivision 2, I'm just wondering if we need that also. I'll move to delete the all sections of the bill except Section 3, Subdivisions 1 and 2, and we'll see how that goes first.
Okay. Everyone understand
sub
the
three,
motion?
Sub 3
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I would urge members to defeat the motion. I think with Senator Fredrickson's proposal to delay the implementation, we are in effect focusing on Section 3, but yet we still have a goal of banning the products, and I think that's really important to do so that manufacturers start developing the alternative processes and we give them plenty of time to do that.
Mr. Chair, I concur. I think the work that Senator Fredrickson and Senator Pappas did at the table got us where we need to go, protecting people that are concerned about some protection, giving us time to review it. I like what Senator Fredrickson got done.
On the amendment, further discussion. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 651 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Further discussion on the motion. Seeing none, on the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
We're going to take Senator Marty's explanation of his bill and his special witnesses, shall we say, who've been very patient, some young people. We apologize that the previous bill lasted so long, but we understand we do some important work in this committee. So why don't we go through your bill, Senator Marty? We'll take some of the kids. Do you have anyone from Greater Minnesota that came a long way?
We do not.
Okay, so then we'll take Senator Marty, and then we'll take the kids, and then we'll continue this on to either the next hearing or one of the subsequent hearings. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Actually, I was hoping you could move it out of here because it has to go to my committee yet as well.
I don't see how we can, given the hour. This is our third. Remember, this is our third meeting today.
I understand. We're meeting downstairs right
now. The committee has done yeoman's work. We'll do our best to hurry this along.
Okay. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, and I do have an A1 amendment, but this bill is the next step in the state's aggressive efforts to reduce mercury contamination. Anybody who's dealt with fishing advisories, fish consumption advisories, or concerned about human health has got to be interested in addressing this issue. State has a goal of reducing 93% the mercury emissions since its peak in the early 90s. Last year, the legislature passed a major, very costly initiative to remove mercury emissions from coal-fired plants. We removed mercury from batteries. Several years ago, we passed a ban on mercury thermometers. This bill addresses the second largest remaining source of mercury emission, mercury in products. And this bill, we've been listening for concerns for various groups. There's one provision that has to be dealt with in our committee that, because of time, I'd encourage you to either remove or wait because it has to come up in our committee dealing with crematoria issues. We also have heard from National Electric Manufacturers Association. We have an amendment that's pretty close. I think we've got agreement with them. We don't have the language worked out yet. They were content to wait till the health committee on that one. But the bill would make significant efforts to reduce mercury in products by banning mercury in many products the way we did thermometers several years ago. There are alternatives available here. So also provide much more information to consumers to let them know what products contain mercury and that they should be that they have to be handled in a different way than other products, including products that we really want to promote, like compact fluorescents, which have small amounts of mercury in. Have Karen Skoog from the IATP to speak briefly to go through the bill, and then we have some young witnesses here.
Thank you, Senator Marty, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I will be extremely brief in my explanation of this bill. Just to walk you through, Section 1 expands recycling requirements for mercury-containing products, and it includes the addition of fluorescent and high-intensity discharge lamps. Section 2 is the provision that Senator Marty indicated. We're working with the National Electrical Manufacturers Association on some amendment changes to the labeling, and we will be introducing that, assuming that we pass this bill out of your committee this evening on Wednesday in the Health Committee. Section 3 clarifies the requirements that were passed in 2006 for utility notification of mercury content in the fluorescent lamps. Sections 4 through 11 deal with the ban on the sale, distribution, and use of a number of mercury-containing devices for which there are proven and cost-effective available mercury-free alternatives. And I believe that the amendment that Senator Marty has here this evening and has a couple of sections. In Section 7 and 8, there are some slight changes to that, just in wording. Section 12, which is also addressed in the amendment, deals with the definition of mercury-containing, what that means. Section 13 has also a change in the amendment. It requires lamp facilities to report to the Pollution Control Agency on an annual basis the number and type of fluorescent lamps that they are collecting. Section 14, also addressed in the amendment, prohibits the purchase and use of elemental mercury and other listed mercury-containing devices in the K-12 schools
by December of the end of this year, and then it provides a two-year timeline for the storage and removal of these devices from K through 12 schools by December of 2009. The Minnesota School Board Association and the Minnesota Association of School Administrators have both, we were consulted with them, and they don't have any problems with the bill language. Section 15 is the section that deals with the removal of the mercury amalgam fillings prior to cremation, and as Senator Marty indicated, we were advised by Senate Counsel that this section actually falls under the jurisdiction of the Health Committee, and so we are drafting an amendment with language that will clarify this section and will be introduced in the Health Committee on Wednesday. Section 16 would require retailers of the fluorescent lamps to provide readable signage at the point of sale that indicates for the mercury content and where to be recycled. And the amendment also this evening would eliminate Section 17, which is the reporting requirement by the PCA, so we are striking that entire section.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. We have an A1 amendment that addresses, it's basically largely technical things. I assume it's in the packets or somewhere up there. In any case, I would hope the committee would consider that tonight. With that, we do have several young witnesses who wanted to before the committee briefly.
Mr. Chair.
This is an author's amendment. Senator Anderson, do you want to move that?
Sure, I'll move it. I have just a clarifying question, too. What can someone tell me what a sphygmomanometer is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, it is a blood pressure cuff.
Thank you. I will move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
On the amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
I believe we have two young people who are going to give a brief statement.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have Natasha and Jack. They are sixth grade students at the Battle Creek Elementary School in St. Paul. Their class has chosen to take on mercury as an issue of interest, and they indicated to us that they really were interested in working on some kind of policy level. So thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and we really appreciate your patience waiting for it. You're getting kind of a lesson on how slow the democratic process can be, but we appreciate your patience in waiting around and go ahead with your testimony. If you please introduce yourself as you begin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Jepson the Spiegelayer. Mercury in schools is a big problem. A stray drop of mercury can last more than a decade in a carpet, all the while giving off dangerous vapors that can damage the brain. So far this school year, three schools have been temporarily shut down due to mercury spills. But does that give us any idea how dangerous mercury is? No, it doesn't. Mercury is to humans what DDT is to birds. Very, very bad. It can severely damage the brain of a developing baby and slightly less severely damage the brain of an adult. That's why I'm testifying at this hearing, for future generations. Perhaps someday soon we can eliminate the need for this dangerous chemical. We're all in the same boat. Please don't sink it. Thank you.
Thank you. Natasha?
My name is Natasha. I bet that we all know that mercury can be dangerous, and I bet that we all know that there have been a lot of mercury spills this school year. If there was a mercury spill in a school that wasn't cleaned up properly, then the staff and students will be exposed to deadly mercury vapors. 80% of the mercury vapors that we breathe in go straight to our bloodstream. Once in your bloodstream, mercury can get to your brain and destroy your brain tissue. It can also affect your nervous system. For smaller children, it can give them lifelong learning disorders because their brains and nervous systems are still developing. Those spills are not only dangerous, but cost a lot too. Now ask yourself, as dangerous and expensive as mercury spills are, why would we allow stores and businesses to continue to sell products that contain mercury? Well, by passing the mercury products bill, which doesn't let stores and businesses sell products that contain mercury, we could help keep mercury out of schools and homes, which would make going to school, work, and to your house safer for everyone.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Questions?
Senator Anderson? Oh, Mr. Chair, if I can just thank the witnesses, too. I think you stayed here for such a long time and were so quiet, quieter than I would have been if I were sitting this whole time. So I just want to thank you for being such good participants and for all the information and research that you did. Thank you so much.
Thoughts before we adjourn, Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is an important bill, and again, as soon as you can get to it, I would very much appreciate it. I think this is the next step in what we've been doing. The state is committed to removing 93% of the mercury from the peak level we have. We've gone down, we've cut it by more than half so far, but we've got a long way to go, and eliminating from these products would do a great deal to get there. And again, 3-4 years ago, we had a mercury thermometer ban. There are perfect alternatives to their use, and it passed. I think that, I'm not sure if there were any votes in opposition in the House or Senate, maybe one or two. I'd urge your support for this and look forward to discussing with you as soon as you can.
Senator Vickerman?
Mr. Chair, are you going to take any amendments tonight?
It had been whispered that Senator Marty, if you want to consider taking out the crematorium part of the bill, maybe it would be less controversial for this committee, and maybe we could just refer it to your committee anyway.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a strong – the bill, have to be in front of my committee, and yeah. Senator Coring, who has strong feelings about this, is on my committee, and we have a long debate about it. And if you want to take it out of the bill now, it's an extra burden to put it into a bill, and I'm happy with that because that's where the issue should be resolved.
Okay.
And I didn't want to take more time on that. And, again, we're trying to resolve as many of these issues as we can. And we have talked with a number of crematory operators and have some amendments that we're not – completed yet, so we weren't ready for them tonight anyway.
Even if we do this amendment, do we have folks who want to testify on the bill otherwise? Particularly against it?
I think there's some. Mr. Anderson may be the only one who I think who, and I'm not sure if it's against or with a concern he wanted to raise.
All right, let's.
Mr. Chair, members, first of all,
hold on a second, Mr. Anderson.
I can't believe I would never let anybody. Could hear me clear down in southwestern Minnesota. This is crazy. This is inhuman. Mr. Chair, I'm going to move to strike out Section 15 because I don't sit on that other thing. To express my deep feeling. I would move we strike Section 50.
Okay. All right. That's the amendment. Does everyone understand? Does anyone want to speak against the amendment? All right. On the Vickerman amendment to delete Section 15, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Okay. So then we've got Senate file 1085. Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Buzz Anderson. I'm with the Minnesota Retailers Association. I wanted to make a comment about Section 16, but I think you all know I also live in the Twin Cities, so I'd be happy to come back if you're going to hear the bill again, or I'll make comments now if you'd like. It's really up to you, Mr. Chair.
The committee's, I'm sensing the committee would just like to send it on. So if you've got remarks to make,
Mr. Chair, members,
I make them.
I've already talked to Senator Marty briefly about the signage requirements to see if we can provide some options for retailers other than just posting a sign. We tend to think that's probably ineffective. We certainly support the bill, but I'm looking for potential options in terms of trying to find a way to let the public know that these have to be disposed of. So, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you. Senator Marty has promised since it's going to his committee, he'll work with me. So I'd be happy to do that and just let it go at that.
So you don't oppose the ban. You have concerns with the signage related to it.
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct.
Okay. Anyone else who would like to testify against Senate File 1085? Senator Stephen.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I can move the bill if it's...
All right, go ahead.
Have we adopted the amendment?
We did adopt the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1085 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Health Policy Committee.
Okay. On the amendment. Excuse me. On the motion.
Right.
All right. This is probably going to be the last stop, time that this committee is going to see this bill. So I just want to make sure that we're not hurrying through, rushing through anything. Okay, I'm not seeing any further discussion. Members, thank you very much for your hard work today. Yes, we're going to vote. But when we vote, I'm not going to get a word in edgewise. I'm the only one standing between you and a pillow right now. So thank you very much for your hard work today. We really appreciate everyone's contribution. All those in favor of the Sieben motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Meeting is adjourned.